The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Things are going to be different, but mostly what we can say is what we won't have anymore. We won't have sexism, we won't have exploitation, we won't have class, but we don't know what new things are going to exist for us. And that the workers of the future probably won't care very much about what we had planned for socialism. Because what socialism's going to look like is going to depend a lot on where the revolution happens, which country it starts in, the economic and social conditions that are there. So in that sense, Engels is right. There's no point in prescribing what socialism will be. But if that's the case, then why would we have this meeting? And one of the reasons is that capitalism makes people feel extremely hopeless, I'm sure. We've all had that experience. Last month, the Center for Disease Control, the CDC, reported that suicide rates have jumped 30% in the last 20 years. And that's not hard to see why. Most people in my generation and in others have crippling debt. We can't imagine ever owning a home. The idea of being able to have a stable job for our lifetimes is laughable. The idea that we could afford to have kids is also kind of out of reach for a lot of us. Last year, Oxfam found that 80% of all of the wealth created in the world went to the top 1%, the rich. So on top of this, people in my generation have also never been part of a winning social movement and never been part of a winning labor struggle, although the teachers are changing that a little bit, I think. So we don't have a whole lot of experiences of alternatives to capitalism. And now we have Trump on top of that. So I think it's easy to feel demoralized in that kind of situation. And having a vision of how society can be better and exactly what that could look like is kind of sustenance and inspiration for us to remember what we're fighting for. So in a socialist society, there are a number of very straightforward things that we could change that are vastly going to improve people's lives. So universal healthcare and education, including college for everybody. Solving homelessness. There are 3.5 million homeless people in this country, and there are 18.5 million empty homes. That's five times. We could house all of the homeless five times over, just as it is now. We would feed everyone on the planet. Right now, a full third of food produced in the world gets wasted, gets destroyed, because the producers would rather do that than not be able to make a profit off selling it. We would massively cut the workday down. There's a Harvard economist who says we could now have a 4-hour workday without sacrificing living standards. There's another economist I found who said we can have a 2.3-hour workday. That's the shortest I found. So part of that would mean spreading the work between people who have too much work to do and people who are unemployed, spreading that out across those people, and using automation differently to how we do now. So instead of that being a way to throw people out of work, that would be a way to make less work for everybody and work easier. We would also get rid of a lot of superfluous industries like marketing and advertising, private health insurance, prison construction. I'm sure people can think of a lot of other industries we will not need under socialism. We'd also massively invest in renewable energy, and not just that, we would start investing in technology that I think people have ideas, scientists have ideas about now, to pull carbon out of the atmosphere to start, stopping the runaway climate change that we're dealing with. And one of my favorite games to play with myself when I'm on the train is to think about how we could pay for all of those things. So to look up how much money there is in the system to pay for all of the cool things that we could have under socialism. So just as an example, if we cut military spending, which is $610 billion a year, and if we shut down the prison complex, or the prison system, that would be nearly another $200 billion a year. So it'd save nearly $800 billion every year. 15, or if we're being generous, 20% of that would be enough to cover free education, college education for everybody for a year. So that's a tremendous amount of money left over after that to pay for the other things that I mentioned. And that's all money that's already being spent by the government. That's before we take all of the wealth away from the ruling class and use it for good. There's many, many billions to do those things. And a lot of countries already have things like free healthcare or education. But we're talking about a far more dramatic and revolutionary shift in the way that we organize society. So the thing that makes socialism different is the total abolition of classes. We won't be divided into classes anymore. There's not going to be a group of people who own the factories and the call centers and the colleges who get rich off the labor of the rest of us. The wealth that's created is going to be collectively owned by all of us. And if there's no longer a tiny elite that owns everything, there won't be a need for a state, a government to protect their interests, and there won't be a need for a police force, a special separate body of armed people to physically protect that ruling class. So we would disarm and disband the police force as well eventually. So those are the basic preconditions for socialism: the abolition of class, the removal of the state and police, and democratic production, a democratic control of production and wealth. And I think actually those are some of the easier tasks of building socialism, and the challenge and kind of the creativity and the fun come in thinking about like changing the ways that we organize our institutions and the ways that we relate differently to each other as people and the way we think about ourselves. So I'm going to share a couple of examples that tell us a bit about the potential we have under socialism. So in 1919, there's this left-wing magazine that interviewed a woman who was married to the head of the Soviet in Siberia after the Civil War. And they asked her how Soviet education is organized. And she says that the teachers just in her town just held a conference and laid out their plan for education. They weren't dictated by the administrators or the standardized test people. I don't think they had standardized testing in Russia at that time, but it wasn't administrators, it was teachers themselves. And they would go home to their students' houses and meet their families and learn about like, what are your challenges for learning? What do you want to learn? What are you interested in? And you know, learn about their lives in that way. And every morning the students would elect a chair for the day of their classroom, and the teachers would just watch. There wasn't intervention in that. And if a student did something wrong, they would hold a tribunal in the classrooms. It's like elementary school. But that was uncommon because kids actually felt accountable to the other kids in their classroom. They didn't want to disrupt anybody else's learning because their needs were being met. There wasn't the kind of disruption that I'm sure many of us have experienced, especially in public schools. So that's the kind of education that we would have under socialism. Teachers would decide what is taught, and children, the students would decide how their classrooms run. I also personally believe that we will abolish all homework. I think that homework only serves to teach us that we're going to have to bring our work, our jobs home with us in the future, and that, you know, to learn discipline and conformity and that sort of thing. So I think socialism would be much more about play and curiosity and adventure than homework. Gender, I think it goes without saying, although I will say it, a socialist revolution is only really complete when we when we fully get rid of all oppression, of all races, of all genders, of all sexualities and every other type of oppression. And that starts firstly with removing all of the legal, technical barriers from oppressed groups. So in the Russian Revolution, the government gave women the vote and allowed them to hold office, which was one of the first countries at the time to do that. The right to divorce, equal pay, maternity leave before and after birth, and legal and free abortion on demand, and government-funded childcare. In the Soviet Union, there was also this campaign against the home-cooked dinner, which I think is funny, because they thought that home-cooked dinners reinforced the idea that women should like wait on their husbands and children hand and foot, and that they should do like two jobs. They should work in a workplace and then come home and work full-time for their families as well. So in the place of women doing that kind of work in the home, the Soviets set up public dining halls, nurseries, and they turned care work into work that was paid, not just something that women are supposed to do because we're naturally caring or whatever. And like women today in developed countries still work 30 hours a week in domestic tasks. That's a full other, nearly full-time job. So that's a lot of time we would all get back under socialism. And so that just didn't just change the amount of time women had and the way that they could spend their days, but also the way that their families thought about them and the way that they thought about themselves. And in every revolution, in every social movement, even, we have to confront and start unlearning the sexist ideas that the systems taught us. And those things don't just evaporate because we've gotten rid of classes. They're going to have to be like arguments and really confronting reactionary ideas to deal with that. One of those things I think will be challenging the oppressive family structure. So that was part of what the home-cooked dinner campaign was trying to do, challenge the family, which is not just about dealing with sexism, but helps us confront things like homophobia and transphobia as well. Because if we have this rigid idea of the family now, so that the ruling class can maintain property relations, get free labor from women, other kinds of social control. And so to maintain that, they have to tell us that there's a right way to have a family, there's a right way to be a man and a woman, there's a right way to have sex, and there's a wrong way way, and we have to police all of the wrong ways. But there's not going to be a need for that kind of gender and sexuality policings when we live in a society, when we live under socialism.
Sorry, can you speak just
about that? Sure. Racism. Obviously, it's very hard to imagine a world without racism right now. I listened to a podcast on the 4th of July that said the US had existed longer with slavery than it has now without slavery. So obviously, the roots are very deep. But I think, imagine for a second that we could go back to the 19th century and tell people that anti-Irish racism has evaporated in the time that we live in, that it's kind of hard to imagine anti-Irish racism for us. They would be very doubtful about that, because the hold of those ideas was very strong in that time. And that's not to say that racism's all the same or that it evaporates over time. That's obviously not our experience. But if racist ideologies can change dramatically throughout capitalism, why can't we get rid of them altogether? We haven't always had racism. There's no reason that we need to continue to have it. So like sexism, the starting point is with the institutional and technical changes, desegregating cities, removing barriers to education and employment, getting rid of poverty. In a socialist society, I think we'd also talk very seriously about reparations for black people in this country and other countries, for indigenous populations who've had genocides committed against them and displacement to repair for that harm. The criminal justice system. I was reading a little bit about the Iroquois and the Navajo communities and the ways that they dealt with crime early on. There was a separation of the idea of like a crime committed and an individual. Like the idea of a criminal didn't really exist. That was like a pathological thing like we have now. Like there's a type of person that's a criminal. And there also wasn't a sense that a certain length of punishment was going to change people's behavior, which is kind of what sentencing is today, right? You punish someone long enough, they pay their debt to society. I'm not clear where that debt goes, like who gets the benefit from that debt. And people kind of learn their lesson, which we know doesn't play out in practice. And I mentioned those two communities not to kind of objectify them or glorify them, but to say that there are many different ways people have organized justice in the past, and there's no reason that we need the system of lawyers and prisons and bourgeois courts and punishment. In Philadelphia in the 90s, they had a system of community, some parts of the town had a system of community courts where they tried to find like the causes of crime and rehabilitate perpetrators. And they had a mediation process that was about repairing harm, not getting revenge or having punishment. And I mean, crimes like theft, which make up a significant number of the crimes in capitalism now, are gonna disappear when we get rid of things like poverty. But we will still need to deal with things like rape and murder and other kinds of crime that aren't related to poverty. Although I think these things will change as well when we start to relate differently to each other around gender and that kind of thing. In terms of culture, this is like a really exciting thing. I hope we can get into it in this discussion. So there's so many examples, but one of them is in the 1920s, this very famous artist and architect, Rodchenko, designed this, like basically a community center that was taller than the Eiffel Tower. It had like three different levels. It was like made of glass and concrete and like rotating and all these different shapes. It was crazy. It never got built, but it was very cool. And it had like rooms for lectures, for playing music, it had a radio station, political meeting rooms, telephone, a projector that could project things onto the clouds. Which is really cool. It had all this cool furniture, like a librarian's desk that could be turned into a stage to have theater productions on. And it was never built because of the poverty and the scarcity and the Civil War and it being Russia. But I think any progressive architect, you could ask them today and they would have very many ideas on how we could build housing and buildings and community centers that would serve ordinary people like that. Under socialism, artists are going to be encouraged to take risks and explore ideas. The thing that that I think about is movies. Like I feel like all movies now are like requels and prequels and remakes and reboots and whatever. Like it's the same thing again and again, because production companies are like, I know that Star Wars or whatever is a safe bet and I'm going to make a lot of money off that. So none of the scripts that are about anything different or new like end up getting made, because they want to do well at the box office. But if that profit motive is gone, then I think the possibilities for art will be will be much bigger. We think we live in the golden age of Netflix now. I feel like Netflix under socialism will be much more interesting. I was reading a memoir recently about an immigrant who from Russia who went to the US before the revolution. He comes back to Minsk in the 1920s to see his friend who had lived through the revolution and the civil war. And the friend says, like, there's terrible poverty and things are bad because of the economic conditions in Russia. But she says that like the neighborhood she lives in used to be called the marsh, like the mud puddle. And she would walk around there just feeling like hated and like she was nothing. And her kids couldn't go to school and they were just like on the lowest social rung in the city. But now since the revolution, they walk around with pride and they feel like they have support from the community in a sense that they belong there. I just think if someone living in like desperate poverty feels that much better after a revolution about themselves, imagine how much better we are going to feel under a fully established system of socialism when we don't live in a system that tells us that we're garbage anymore. So there are a lot of things we can't know about socialism. Like Engels says, there's debates that go on in the left, will everybody be bisexual when we get rid of homophobia? I don't believe that that is true, but that is a real debate. Will humans still have a need for religion when we get rid of some of the material foundations that have people look for ideas like that? Will sex be a kind of work still that is exchanged? I don't know the answers to those things, but you know, we should talk about them. So I've tried to just sketch out some of the things that we can plan for, with obvious holes, like we haven't talked about aged care or disability or things like that. There's lots of different aspects of it to talk about. But before I wrapped up, I wanted to do a couple of myth busters about socialism. I feel like probably everyone's been in the situation where you're at like a family dinner or a party and like you get outed as a socialist, either by yourself or somebody else. And people are like, oh, well, it's a very good idea in theory, but what about in practice? So there's just a couple of questions that I feel like come up again and again in those situations that I have been developing some answers to. So people are like, how can we have socialism if our nature is just to be selfish and jealous and competitive? We have a food analogy. You don't count how many pancakes there are on a table. You don't count how many pancakes the person next to you is eating if there are enough pancakes for everybody. It's not in our nature to be jealous or greedy. It's the scarcity and the competition of the system that creates that feeling. If we lived in a system, we live in a system that rewards jealousy and competition now. If we lived in a system that rewarded or supported community and collaboration, we would act very differently. It's a relatively short amount of human history that we've lived in a class society that we've been this way, so I'm very cautious about calling anything human nature, and that there's some sort of unchanging part of us that is jealous and competitive. Won't people be lazy under socialism? So I have another food analogy. I was obviously hungry when I wrote my talk. If you're making a cake and you know that you're going to get to eat the cake, you're going to make a really delicious cake, right? You're not going to be flaky, you're not going to cut corners, you're not going to make a crappy cake, you're like, someone else is going to deal with that. Like, you're going to make it delicious. So doing labor, I think, doing work is not something that people want to avoid in general. It's when we have no control over what we produce and how we produce it that we get lazy and kind of switch off. People zone out because they know that they have to get up and go to the same job again tomorrow under capitalism. But labor itself, I think, is very human and very sustaining. Actually, I think labor is what makes us human. And if the work that we do is about improving our lives and improving the lives of the people that we care about, work is going to feel very different and not so alienating and soul-destroying. Not like that at all. Who will do the unpleasant jobs under socialism? I just feel like if we can put a man on the moon, why can't we make a toilet cleaner or whatever? Like, we have dishwashers and we have washing machines and all this kind of stuff that's like revolutionized the way that we do housework or work that people don't want to do. And automation, I think, could deal a lot with that. And actually, I think that the worst work in life is not the work that's dirty, it's the work where you have to screw somebody else over. Like, I imagine being like a debt collector, like how horrible that must be every day to call people up and get their debts, which is obviously an industry we will be 100% abolishing under socialism. Should garbage men get paid the same amount as a doctor? I feel like people say that a lot, that comparison. To be honest, our cities would be a much worse public health disaster without garbage men than without doctors. that kind of work is in the same totality of keeping humans healthy. There's just one that is valued and one that is not valued. And why should one get paid more than the other? So in socialism, our wages and the value of our work will be kind of far more equalized across industries. And also doctors don't just study to get paid well. Like, I assume most doctors care about providing healthcare for people. So I don't think that like the money is what drives them to get those skills. And in socialism, everyone's going to have the opportunity to study, whether that's to write poetry or be a surgeon or whatever. Like, that will be opened up to all of us. My last myth buster: don't we need competition and innovation for technology? Again, no. I think that if we have centralized planning of technology that we develop, we will have much better technology, and we will get to technological advancement much quicker than what we have now. Like, if you imagine if the Soviet Union and the US weren't competing to get to space, they would have both gotten to space a lot quicker if people share resources and ideas instead of competing for it. So I'm going to wrap up. like I said at the beginning, there's a tremendous amount of money in the system. There's more wealth in the system now than there has ever been in the world. So we obviously have the material capacity to have socialism. We also have the ideas and the examples that I shared, but you know, there are geographers and urban planners and doctors and nurses and teachers and all these people who have all kinds of ideas for how they could run their industry better. And that's because we already run everything in society. We already know how to do it. We just don't have control over it. We don't have the power. I think the possibilities are kind of endless with our creativity. I'm just going to finish with a little bit from Lenin, from his pamphlet, What is to be Done, from 1902. And in a part of it, he asks if socialists should be allowed to dream, because Marx and Engels talk about, like, we've got practical tasks to be getting on with. But Lenin says that actually there's no harm in dreaming if you take your dreams seriously, because dreams help give you the energy and the inspiration for the practical tasks of the day, which are sometimes very challenging. I'm sure that's not news to anyone. So he says, in fact, that socialists should do more dreaming about what the world could look like, because that keeps our focus, that keeps us fighting for what we're fighting for. So I think we should take that advice, hopefully in this room and then outside the conference as well.
Okay, so Claire laid out a really good idea of what Marx called the higher stage of communism would be like. And what I'm going to do is talk about the transition period between the time workers take power, you have a revolution, you get rid of the capitalist class domination, and you proceed all the way to higher stage of communism. I'm going to talk about some of those issues. So for Marx, the road to his goal of communism was paved by the achievement of working class power. He felt that when workers took power, they could actually begin the transition to communism. So Marx originally started out as a communist, and then as he developed further, he discovered that it was actually the working class that could bring about communism, and he became an advocate of the power of the working class. He felt that the working class was the class that could bring about communism because it had no form of property of its own that is productive property to defend. It was a class that had what he called radical chains. In other words, if you broke the chains, you had a radical result. The bottom part of society moved up and could eliminate all class distinctions. It was a collective class. It was a class that made things collectively. It could not like divide little things up and compete with each other that way. Instead, it had to produce things collectively, and therefore it had the potential of being democratic. And he felt that the struggle against exploitation, which is part of capitalism, that is, workers go on strike, they fight back, they try to get better conditions, they try to get better wages and so forth, that the victory of that struggle could lead to the abolition of exploitation, getting rid of the whole structure of exploitation and eliminating classes. So Marx summarized it by saying, What I did was that was new was to prove that the existence of classes is only bound up with particular phases in the development of production, that the class struggle necessarily leads to the dictatorship of the proletariat. We'll get into a minute what that means. And that this dictatorship itself only constitutes the transition to the abolition of all classes, and therefore to the withering away of the state. So who is the working class that Marx was talking about? Well, it was not just factory workers or even blue-collar workers. It's all people who produce surplus value, that is, who are exploited and have their work taken by the capitalist and used to produce capital. And it's all other people who actually make the system run and make it possible for workers to be exploited. So in today's world, it's not just factory workers or farm workers or whatever, but it's also teachers, nurses, janitors, IT workers, waiters, cooks, etc. It's people who work for a wage and either produce the surplus value that creates capital, or they produce the conditions that allow other people to produce that. So the scenario that Marx laid out was that, first of all, the working class would have to win the battle of democracy. This is in the Communist Manifesto. He said the first step in the revolution by the working class must be to raise the proletariat to the position of the ruling class. In other words, the working class must take political domination over society, must sweep away the capitalist state, and so forth. And so what he meant by the winning the battle of democracy was, first of all, having a revolution, and by that he meant smashing the old capitalist state, the court system, the police, the armies, and so forth, and instead replacing that with workers' power, with workers' institutions, workers' organizations. And the reason he felt this is because states under capitalism are committed to exploitation. Their whole economy that they're based on is based on capitalist exploitation of workers, and they've been conditioned and so forth to do this. So therefore, they can't just switch over and go to support communism or something. They're committed to capitalism. The ruling class or capitalist interests dominate the personnel at the top. So you look at who runs look at the Congress and all that in the U.S. The net wealth of people in Congress is like 5 to 10 times what the ordinary person is in the United States. That's just one example of that. But it's not just the people at the top. It's also the fact that capitalist states are in a world economy and they have to compete with other capitalist states, and therefore they have to augment their own economy, which means supporting the idea of increasing capitalist profit. So for Marx, revolution meant smashing the state, or as he put it, the next attempt of the French Revolution would be no longer, as before, to transfer the bureaucratic military machine from one hand to the other, but to smash it and replace it with workers' institutions. In the case of France, what he's talking about, the Paris Commune of 1871, workers set up a commune with elected and recallable delegates that coordinated both the political aspects of society and the economy. In the Russian Revolution, the Soviets or workers' councils played that role. So what did Marx mean by the dictatorship of the proletariat? Now, this is a word that is unfortunate, is a little bit unfortunate today, because when people think of dictatorship, they think of one person, or they think of, that, or a small group of people dictating to other people. But for what Marx meant by this was the dictatorship of the proletariat, that is the whole working class, running society democratically. So it was a grassroots democratic control by the whole working class, not a small group of people. And the reason he used the word dictatorship, because in the 1800s, the word was used in a different way. So in the 1800s, Marx would have said that capitalist society was a bourgeois dictatorship. No matter what form it took, no matter whether it was a parliamentary democracy or it was a military dictatorship or whatever, the society was dominated by the capitalist class, or what he called the bourgeoisie. In a transition period after the revolution, the society will be dominated or dictated to by the whole working class. So that's what he meant by a dictatorship of the proletariat. That means that all power will be in the hands of the working class, and the bourgeoisie or the capitalist class will be dispossessed of political power. Because otherwise, if they still had some political power, they would use it to thwart the transition to communism. Now, there are other ideas of what the transition to socialism would be like. There's one put forward by a revolutionary in the late 1800s called Blanqui, and this was an educational dictatorship. His idea was that an incorruptible, well-intentioned elite would take power, and they would reorganize society from the top, and they would retrain the working class or the mass of the population to be good socialist people. So this was kind of his idea of that. A similar idea, really, today, is by people who support the ideas of Stalin or even Mao or Castro, where a few revolutionaries take power at the top, and then they re-educate people from the top. So this is very similar to the educational dictatorship of Blanqui. And what Che Guevara called the socialist man will be created by the people at the top reorganizing things. So that's one idea. And a very similar idea, is the utopian socialist concept, where Robert Owen or other people who are socialists would set up communes, and they would structure the way the commune was set up, and then they'd have people come into the commune, and they would learn to be good people by being part of this commune. And another similar approach of what Hal Draper calls socialism from above is the idea of the social democrats or the reformists, that you can just reform capitalist society a little bit at a time by passing better laws. So you rely on politicians, you rely on people at the top to rechange things. Now, what's wrong with these conceptions? Well, first of all, if you allow an elite at the top that's unaccountable and undemocratically controlled to run things, they develop their own interests. They're not necessarily going to pursue the interests of ordinary people. And even more fundamentally, perhaps, is that the goal of the transition is a democratic society, and it can only be achieved by democratic struggle. A big part of it is that the relations of people at work will be changed. That is, when workers go to work, they will no longer just obey the orders of the managers and the foremen. They will reorganize the way work is done. And you can't do that, you can't make that happen by passing a law or anything like that from the top. It can only be done by the action of people from below. And Marx put it this way: revolution is necessary not only because the ruling class cannot be overthrown in any other way, but also because only in a revolution can the class overthrowing it succeed in ridding itself of the muck of ages and become fitted to found society anew. And part of this means is that as workers struggle to change society, they change their own relations with other people. This is part of how racism, sexism, etc., all forms of oppression or oppressive ideas are overcome. Because when people fight together, those things are weakened and they're not totally eliminated. It's not like everything's going to be magic the day after the revolution, but large steps need to be taken towards overcoming these kind of oppressive ideologies. Now, there's one final conception of the transition, which is the anarchist conception, which is actually no transition. And what that means is you have a revolution one day, and the next day you have communism. Everything's cool. And I mean, there's a lot of people who actually hold this position. Okay, so there's two problems with this. You need a worker state in a transitionary period to overcome the resistance of the capitalists. The capitalists, when their state is overthrown, are not going to just go, oh, okay, yeah, I guess we lost, we'll go home, whatever. They're going to fight back. So in the Russian Revolution, there was a civil war. You know, you could look at the Paris Commune. They actually crushed the commune with the French army and all that kind of stuff. So there will be resistance from the capitalist class. So you need an organized force of workers together, workers' militias and so forth, to stop that from happening. And just as importantly, you need a worker state because you need to use the political power of the working class to make the transition to communism. There are a whole bunch of changes that need to take place between capitalism to get to the higher stage of communism that we talked about. There's overcoming class exploitation. There's overcoming the division of income. There's overcoming the profit domination of society. There's overcoming war and nationalism, overcoming all various forms of oppression. So first of all, just on the first part of overcoming class exploitation, the worker state will expropriate the productive property of the capitalist class and place it under workers' control. Large sections of the economy will be nationalized under the control of workers. But at first, workers haven't had the experience of actually running industry. So there's a stage of workers' control where the workers check the management and make sure that they're doing things in the interests of workers. But over time, workers will learn to manage as well as control. They'll learn to manage industry and the offices and so forth. And as they do that, the need for a separate class or group of managers will disappear. Workers will begin to manage things themselves over time. And this is part of what Marx talked about when he talked about overcoming the division between mental and manual labor. Because now we have a society in which some people direct and other people carry things out. And in a communist or socialist society, that will be overcome and everybody will direct, will do mental labor as well as physical labor. We'll need to overcome the division of income. So first of all, we'll raise the wages of the lower paid people, tax the more well-off, etc. But over time, as the economy ramps up, more and more of necessities of society will become free. And the money system itself will diminish over time. So there'll be less and less need for money, less and less need for wages, until you finally get to the society that Claire was just talking about, where it's from each according to their ability, to each according to their needs, and everything is provided. We'll need to overcome the profit domination of the society, and that comes about because of competition. And as soon as you have a revolution and workers take control in one state, that doesn't necessarily mean that competition is done away with. Unless the revolution immediately spreads internationally, which is unlikely, it's going to take a little time to spread internationally. So during that time, there'll still be that competition, and the drive for profit will still be there to a certain extent, even though it'll be limited by the fact that workers control society. As planning replaces the market, the drive for profit diminishes as well. And as the revolution spreads internationally, that also reduces competition and therefore the drive for profit. This relates to war and nationalism. The worker state, once workers take power in one country, they'll try to help spread it to other countries. That can't be done by invasion or something, but they'll give it support around the world. And so the need for military defense will actually decline over time as the revolution spreads. But at first, there will be need for that military defense, which means that some of the resources of society are going to have to go, are going to have to go into accumulation in order to have the military. Over time, in a fully developed communist society, you wouldn't have a military. So over time, there'll be that transition as the revolution spreads, and less will need to be spent on that kind of thing. Overcoming oppression is another very, very important thing. There'll have to be mass educational campaigns as well, but there'll have to be institutional restructuring, which you might call affirmative action on steroids in a real way, so that we don't just have, you know, all the vast majority of professors aren't white men, and then you have, you know, the janitors are all people of color and that kind of stuff. All of that will have to be restructured so that the basis, the material basis of racism, sexism, etc., is overcome. And it's not just a matter of debating ideas and trying to win people, although that will be part of it. We'll need to retool industry to save the earth, because right now, of course, in the current approach, we're going to destroy the earth. So all of that kind of stuff will have to be redone, and that will take time. There will be debates about how this stuff will be carried out. It's not like there's one plan that somebody has and everybody will just go along with it. There's going to be debates about what emphasis should we put on what, how should we do it, and so forth. There will be the need to have political parties as well as freedom of expression, freedom of speech, and so forth. So how do we characterize this transition period between the time workers take power and the time we arrive at full, you know, the higher stage of communism that Marx talked about? On the left, there has often been the idea that this stage should be called socialism, whereas for Marx, socialism and communism were identical. So you have Engels talking about socialism, utopian, and scientific, and at the same time, they talked about themselves as communists, being members of the Communist League and so forth. So for them, those two were identical. And in fact, I think we should characterize the transition as just what it is, a transition between two different modes of production, between capitalism and the higher stage of communism. And it doesn't make much sense to designate that stage in between as some other mode of production, because it really what it is a progressive movement of the working class trying to change capitalism into communism. I also believe that characterizing that period as socialism has benefited both reform socialists and Stalinists, but we can get into that in discussion if people want to. So there's possible problems with the transition as well. Once workers take power, there will be a dynamic in the direction of consolidation of democracy and towards total elimination of classes. However, success is not inevitable, and we saw that in Russia, where the revolution didn't spread, and therefore it was finally overthrown and state capitalism was created. Capitalists and ex-capitalists will try to restore power themselves to power. International isolation can be a real problem. If workers are not vigilant, there could be a bureaucratic layer that would build up that would divert the society in a bureaucratic direction. The residual economic power of the capitalists could undermine workers' democracy. So a successful transition is not inevitable, but it has to be fought for. The working class will need to keep the tasks of the transition in mind and continue to fight for them. Over time, as classes disappear and social problems are solved, the need for a repressive apparatus disappears and the state, as Marx put it, withers away, because there's no need to repress anybody who's trying to restore capitalism. The battle for the higher stage of communism is necessary to save the human race and the earth. Our success is not inevitable, but it is entirely possible. Another world is possible, a socialist world is possible. Marx's statement at the end of the Communist Manifesto is as applicable as ever. Workers of the world unite, you have nothing to lose but your chains and a world to win.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.